All right. I'm Lee, I'm an alcoholic. I was told that get sober by about 30 minutes and don't go over an hour. So everybody's not, so we got a time on this, and I wrote a couple of notes here. I don't like to see speakers but notes, but I do have one that I learned from my good friend Ralph S. that said, breathe. And the second one that said, it's not about me. And the other thing it says, thank Milton. I knew before I got into myself here, I'd forget to thank somebody. Thanks for asking me. He asked me about 9 months ago, and my first thought was, how's my life going to be different by then? And it has been a lot. But I was thinking today, it's a little bit, that's the longest I've ever been asked to speak, 9 months ahead of time. And that's a little bit different from the shortest time I've ever been asked to speak. Last year, Joel from the Hickory Hill Group in Memphis called me up about 6 o'clock on a Saturday night. And he said, can you come talk at 8 o'clock at our 34th annual birthday party? I said, Joe, I can. I'd love to. But, you know, if you remember, I talked at your 30th anniversary. But I don't think anybody wants to hear me again. He says, yeah, I know. But the guy who was supposed to speak couldn't make it. And I had a list of 12 people, and you're the last on the list. That's a true story. And his daughter, Sherry, was sitting right. I could hear him in the back. Don't ask him like that. Don't ask him like that. Who else am I supposed to thank? Oh, yeah, I'm supposed to thank Dave. Dave, I've been working with him for 6 years, and he's a miracle man. And we've walked hand in hand down the path of spiritual progress. And I watched him 6 years ago. When he was getting one supervised visit with his daughter a week, and he was going to Arkansas to shovel rice to get Christmas money. Now he, part owner of the company, he gets his daughter whenever he wants, and that's God working somehow. And he did that just by working the 12 steps of recovery. And by me being smart enough to know every time he asked me a question, I just said pray about it, or else let me ask my sponsor and I get back to you. Hey, what day is November 22nd? I've been sober since June 4th of 2001. My first AA meeting was September 9th, 1993. And from 1993 to 2001 was some serious misery and craziness. Before 93, it was crazy. It was dysfunction or whatever. From 93 to 2001, going in and out of the rooms of AA, it was some serious craziness. Today is sort of an anniversary. I was in treatment for 6 months in 2001, everybody would always remember. I was sitting around with a bunch of young guys, and they were talking about where they were, and very few of them remember where they were when Kennedy got shot, and some of them remember this or that, and they started talking about 9/11, where they were when they got shot. And I said, I know where I was. I was in the Copac Treatment Center, and the one TV, and the one meeting room there watching the Twin Towers come down. Some scary times for my family and for me and everything else. But it was 8 years ago today that I got out of treatment. I have those days memorized. I was in one, got thrown out of one, went to another one, and ended up there. And on November 22nd, I went home. As you might expect, there were no yellow ribbons tied around any trees when I got home. After 6 months of treatment and the craziness that had been going on. And I remember the very first day I got home, my wife sat me down and told me exactly how the cow ate the cabbage, how it was going to be, that they were getting along real fine without me. If I wanted to be there, I could stay. But the only reason that we were still together, it was financially a mess. She was going back to work, and I just sat there and listened for the first time in my life. She said that might have been the very first time she noticed a change in me, is that I didn't fight back and I didn't say yes but, and I just sat there and listened. Those were some crazy times. I want to thank all the speakers, and I remember Renee talked about page 29 about how we get our personal relationship with God, and that's one of my favorite pages, and I think that's what all the speakers did all the weekend. It showed how they got a personal relationship with God, and I appreciate that. My favorite page that I also quote relates to that is page 50, when it says the speaker talks about how we conceive and approach a power greater than ourselves. I can tell right now how I approach this power greater than myself. That's with a lot of gratitude. The things that have been restored, I want to say restored in my life. There wasn't much that was worth restoring when I got here, but that's been created in my life. And how I conceive of this power greater than myself. Right now, the conception is how Ebby told Bill, did not know time and did not know limitations. And that's the way I conceive of that power greater than myself, because of what I've seen in others, what I've seen happen in my own life. And the book says, our own conception, however inadequate, is okay to start. And it was inadequate when I got here. You know what? It's still inadequate today a lot of times. And the way I can tell it's inadequate is because everything that's happened in my life, all the good things, work, family, children, everything that's happened in my life, there are still times, more often than not, than I'll say, God, I can take care of this. I don't think you've got all the facts. Let me explain it to you better. I'll get back to you. You've done real well on alcohol. You've done real well on this. But, you know, and that's just me, you know, wanting to take over things again. And that's just me going by that. My favorite story of all the little stories I heard is about the mountain climber who's in the darkness of night. He's climbing up the mountain. The clouds are in there. There's no starlight or anything. And he slips and he's falling down into space and he's cutting the mountain. I mean, he's hanging by his waist from the rope. And for that time, he's laying there and he's going, God, help me. He said, what do you want? He said, help me. And God said, cut the rope. He says, I can't cut the rope. I'm scared. He says, cut the rope. He says, no, I think I'm just going to hold on to it. And the next morning, the search party finds him frozen to death, holding on to the rope 10 feet above the ground. You know, and that's the way it was when I got here. And I mean, how many ropes do I want to hold on to? I do it all the time when I just don't want to trust God. I just want to do things. Let me get this done one more time my way, and everything will be all right. And that happens right now in recovery, and I wish I could do it better. And it's easy for me when people I'm working with come to me and say, I'm not doing this right. I should be farther along. Or I did this, and I shouldn't have done that. And I'm going, it's easy for me to say, don't beat yourself up. You know, when you've had enough, you'll quit doing it. Everything's going to be all right. You're right where you're supposed to be. And, you know, because when we beat ourselves up, that's just saying that we know better for ourselves. But let me go through that. I can feel so guilty, and I can feel so inadequate, and I can feel like that things aren't going right, and nothing's going to be okay, and God's not going to take care of me. That's my own inadequate conception of God. And eventually I get to the point, you know, we all get to the point in recovery. We're either going to drink or we're going to say, God, help me. Plain and simple. Anybody hadn't, what's her name, Melanie? Hang on for the ride, girl. We are so glad you're here. I mean, that's why we're here, to help somebody new like you. We get so excited because we know you do this program as directed and get into this power grant yourself, your life will be unimaginable to what you can believe. So we are so glad you're here. By the way, I'm not the spiritual type of speaker. When Milton asked me to be Sunday morning, I'm a Friday night guy. I got a few jokes I can tell. I did some crazy things when I was drinking. I did some crazy things in treatment. I've done a lot of crazy things in recovery. Tell a few jokes, tell a few stories, and get everybody in the mood and everything. The only good thing about Sunday night for a self-absorbed, talking on Sunday morning for a self-absorbed alcoholic is one way or another, y'all going to be talking about me on the way home. Anybody ever seen the movie My Big Fat Greek Wedding? Every bit of that is true. I am Greek. I was 5 years old before I could speak English. That's all we spoke at our house. I had a little kicker in there. My daddy was the priest, so I could do no wrong. I was always held up to higher standards. Everything was in there strict. It was well understood. I was never going to leave home for school. I was only going to date girls of my faith. I was only going to marry girls of my faith for sure, and that's just the way it was. And by the way, my father's name is Nick, and my son's name is Nick. And it doesn't have to be Greek to be in that ethnic thing. Anybody that's from any ethnic family knows exactly what I'm talking about. Arlene with all her, you know, the Jewish clan and everything. You know, there's a close-knit thing there, and that's just the way my furniture was plastic covered in my house. I was not allowed in certain rooms of the house. This is just the way it was. I mean, and when my mother said no, no meant no. And the worst thing you could hear was, wait till I tell your father. And I was raised like that. But I was also, I was the chosen one because I was the preacher's kid. If I could go somewhere, then all the other kids in the church could go somewhere. And because they figured, I guess the parents figured if he got in trouble, then it wouldn't be, you know, if my kids got in trouble and the preacher's kid was there, it'd be okay. And I was just a little nerd, and you know, all that stuff you hear about that didn't fit in, that was me. You know, one minute I'm the goal, you know, I'm a little bit better than everybody because I'm the preacher's kid. Next minute, I don't belong. And I went to a high school that was sort of, you know, on the borderline between the high class kids. And I was one block over, I'd have gone to Treadwell. And but I ended up going to East. Anybody that's from Memphis knows that. By the way, God, did I forget to mention that my home group is Unity? I feel so terrible about that. Girls, here they are over here. Unity is the best home group in Memphis, and the motto is the girls are women and the men know their place. And and let me tell you about the women of Unity. They're the ones that taught me how to treat women with respect because they're respectable women. The men didn't teach me. The women taught me at Unity. And there's no BS and there's no 13-stepping done at Unity. If you do, you get called out, you get talked to, and you don't do it much more. I didn't mean to get off subject, but I wanted to thank them for being here. But so I was the preacher's kid, and I was always less than, and I did the right thing, you know, I had a little of imagination, a little ego, because I can remember it at 12, 13 years old. I remember marching into my family and said, I'm going to be a doctor. And I don't know where I got this idea. And I said, and I was very proud of myself, says, I'm not going to be any doctor. I'm going to be an ophthalmologist, a world-famous eye surgeon that can only perform the one surgery that nobody else can. They come to me from all over the world. And I'm going to have a special table reserved at this restaurant in Paris. It's going to be roped off only for me in case I'm in town. And I have this vision of me sitting there at the table with my secretary. It's a table about two or three steps up above everybody, roped off, and this little lady in a shawl comes up and asks me to help her child's sight, and I say, I'll take care of it. This is me at 12 years old and I hadn't had a drink yet. And when I did become a physician, and after treatment and all that, and I take care of a lot. I've lowered my sights a little bit. I take care of a lot of people in the program now, and I was under the mistaken impression that people in the program would come see me, and they would trust me. They would know that I understood them, and whatever I told them to do and suggested that they do. Wrong. They're the worst patients I got. Go figure. They're just alcoholics, and you know they're going to do it their way. And I don't know if they're just looking for me to sign off on their BS or whatever, but it's just the way it is. And I've gotten used to it. I don't take it personally anymore. Let me tell you what happened. I'm hanging around with some kids after church. They like to party. And we do a little drinking in the Greek church and everything. And I didn't, but at 16 years old, they were drinking. And I got in some wild turkey. I had the time of my life. It was wonderful. I got drunk, passed out, threw up, and they did tell me I did a lot of cute things that night. I was running around telling everybody I'm the preacher's kid. I can do anything I want to. And I was about 16 years old, and I woke up in my bed. I remember my parents looking down at me. I'd gotten sick and everything, and it was a big scandal in the church. Lee had gotten drunk. I was grounded for about 2 years, and but all I can remember, it was a great time. And I didn't do any more of that for a long time till I got to college. And for some reason, I'd hang around with my buddies, and I was sort of away from the parents. I used to drink to get drunk, and it's just the way it was. Everybody else drank. All my friends drank. They had a good time. It seemed to me that I was the one getting carried home. I had sort of the nickname of the battering ram because I was, you know, one guy had my head, one guy had my leg, and they dumped me in the bed. And I was the one that could party, go over in the corner, put my finger down my throat, get sick, let's go party some more. And I did a lot of cute things when I was drunk. Ole Miss Memphis State football game once, I remember the first quarter. It was Archie Manning's very first game as a sophomore. And I remember the first quarter, the next thing I remember, I was in the bathroom stall. And some guy with the flashlight's coming in there, and my head's on the toilet seat, said, "You got to go." And I had passed out in the first quarter in the bathroom, and 50,000 people had filed out, and they had unlocked the gate to let me out. And that was my badge of honor for a long time. You know, I got drunk in the morning, and passed out. And everywhere I went, I got drunk, passed out, and it was fun. You know, if it was a game or party going on, I'm thinking Monday, I'm going to get drunk. And that was just normal. I thought I was on the party side of normal, and because everybody's doing it, but I'm the one passing out. I'm the one getting carried home. And I got through college with good grades, and for some reason I was in pre-med, and I got into medical school, and had to cut down. I was working full-time all the time. And, you know, through college and medical school, I worked full-time. My parents didn't have any money, and they never paid a dime for any of my education. The reason I'm telling you that is that was part of what kept me so independent, so out of this program for so long, because I could say, I got myself into this, I get myself out. I can do anything I set my mind to do. And I did for a lot of things, but it just didn't work on alcohol. So I got into medical school, and all of a sudden this girl moves to town who's half Greek, half Italian, and she goes to my church. She's beautiful, well-built. She likes me, I like her, we got along all right. My parents liked her, that was the most important thing. So we decided, let's get married. And we did. It was a big, lavish wedding, oversized and everything. And we had a child pretty soon thereafter. And like I said, I didn't have a lot of problems. I was sort of a nerd. And I never dated much, hardly at all, before I got married. I kind of waited till after I got married. That's just the way it was, and I was a late bloomer, and about the nicest thing I can say is I had a lot of relationships that overlapped. How does that sound? It's nice for a Sunday morning speaker to say it like that. So, and sure enough, or I was interviewing the second wife or whatever, I can say that too, but sure enough, after about 5 years, I was real careful in medical school because I was always working, but if there was a medical school party going on, Lee was getting drunk. In fact, our graduation party, we had a progressive dinner where you go have appetizers at one house and a salad the other. I made it to the salad and passed out right there in their backyard. And my wife was good with that. She was used to it. She had somebody take me home and just say, "Leave him in the backyard. I'll get him. And she stayed for the party. It didn't bother her. And it certainly didn't bother me. It was just another something I could brag about. Sure enough, I did find that second wife. I left the first one and got this second one. We had 3 kids in 3 years. And I got out of medical school and I went to private practice. And I just like to get drunk, but I was very careful in private practice. That's where, not many things you can have problems with except showing up in the emergency room to see a patient with alcohol on your breath. They don't like that. And so I was very careful. I had principles. And so it was just the nights I was on call, I didn't drink. Those were bad nights. But if I wasn't, I was home getting drunk with, eating very little, drinking whatever I could. Or most of the time I wasn't home, I was out with my buds doing whatever and being in the wrong places. And I'd get home and we had 3 children there. We had 3 under 3 real quick with this wife. And it was just, and I was busy in practice. And my idea of being a father was, here's the money, you raise them. I mean, I'm busy. If there's something that, some function that the children need me for, I need to be at, let me know and I'll put it on my calendar. And my idea as a son was my father and mother raised me too strict and I was never going to be that way. I was going to give my kids everything, and parents, I'd deal with them later. They were just too strict. I didn't, you know, everybody knew my father. He's a well-known retired minister in Memphis who was way ahead of his time. And, you know, he was in 1968 when Martin Luther King died. There was a picture of him on the front page at the mayor's office trying to help settle the violence. And back then in 68, for a white minister to do that was not the thing to do. He was way ahead of his time. I mean, now that, you know, it is the thing to do for all ministers to do that and come together. Back then it was very controversial, and he was criticized a lot in the church parish and everything. Everybody knew him as a great person. I knew him as a father. And everybody that's been through that knows exactly what I'm talking about. And what I've learned about my parents, they did the best they could with what they had. But he did awfully good. So I had this second wife, kids, and one day I'm in practice working, and I was very careful with my drinking, and a drug rep brought me some codeine cough syrup. And let me tell you, if I'd have known I was going to be in AA someday up here talking, I never would have taken it. But a few days later, I took this codeine cough syrup, and it was instant heaven. I was working, and I was almost doing the moonwalk down in the office. And let me tell you what came to my mind that day. Two things. One, now I know why these patients are manipulating me to get this stuff. Arlene being one of them. All right, I told on you. And the most important thing is now I got something to do during the daytime. And you can't smell it all. So I could drink at night, I could party hard all I wanted, and during the daytime, I got me some instant energy. This was heaven. I had everything covered. So I did that. That led to years and years of me going through a lot of phases. I went through the fast car phase of you know, I never was much in the cars, but all of a sudden I had to have this 6-speed Dodge Stealth. And I might have been the only person that had 3 kids under 10 years old, and I had a car with no back seat. And I went through the baseball card collecting phase, and I went through the Super Bowl program. I just had to collect things because I wanted them. I didn't need anything. Then later on, I ended up going through the computer phase where I learned about computers and buying software and hardware and stuff that I was planning on learning how to do and everything. I still got software and shrink wrap that's never been opened and everything. And I went through all this stuff, and I went through the church, going back to church phase, and I was on the church board, and that lasted a year because I was always so combative at meetings, plus if I showed up at them. And it was just a whole lot of years of back and forth with alcohol, drinking, showing up at meetings drunk, at church and whatever, and being high all the time at work and losing patience And that lasted a lot. I don't know what day it started, and I don't know, but I do know on September 9th, I do know in September of 1993, I asked somebody to help me. When I was making rounds, I talked to a psychiatrist, said, "I'm taking a few too many pills. Can you help me?" He said, "No, I can't, but I'll get you somebody who can." And he sent me to an addictionologist, and he sat there and listened to me. He says, "I'll tell you what I want you to do. I want you to quit taking pills, and I want you to quit drinking. And I want you to go to this AA meeting on Thursday nights at 8 o'clock. It's for doctors only." I said, "I'll quit taking pills, and I'll go to that meeting, but what does this have to do with alcohol? I mean, I like my wine with dinner. I'm a wine connoisseur. I mean, at the end I was drinking box wines, but I like my wine with dinner. I like my scotch and, you know, scotch on the rocks whatever. I like Bloody Marys in the morning, and I like my beer at football games. I mean, what does this have to do with all this pill stuff? And I just get drunk when everybody else does. But I'll quit. I won't do that." So I went to this meeting, and I parked. Naturally, I parked across the street and looked up and down the street. Didn't want anybody to see me running in there, and I zoomed in there and everything. And I walked in there, and I was never so mortified in all my life. All I saw was doctors that I worked with there. I refer patients to them. They refer patients to me. How am I going to make rounds without seeing them in the hall anymore? I'm going to have to change everything. I'm going to have to change the time I make rounds. I mean, it never once, you know, and I'm thinking, what do they think of me? Never once did it come into my mind that, what are they doing there? They were all there, and they were so welcoming and so glad to see me, and they had a newcomer meeting for me. And they all went around and told me a little something about themselves. And let me tell you, here's the only thing I remember about that meeting. Every one of them had been to treatment, and I hadn't. Naturally, I wasn't that bad. And they gave me this big book, and I'm going to tell you, I looked over the steps, and over the first couple of meetings, I went once a week for 9 months. I was busy. I couldn't get more than once a week. And I looked at the steps. None of them applied to me. The only one that could possibly apply to me was, I'll say I'm sorry to somebody if they say it first. And that's about it. The only chapter that made any sense in the whole thing was to the wives. And in fact, I went home. I said, honey, I joined AA. Read this. And I laid it open there for her. And she didn't read it. Still hadn't read it. So I stayed 9 months. And anytime anybody ever talked about God in a meeting, I say, what a spiritual blowhard. What are you talking about? I mean, I'm a preacher's kid. I've got a pipeline to God. I know about this stuff. What does this have to do with me not drinking? Hello? And naturally, after 9 months, I take a few pills. I started drinking and sneaking back out there. And for a year and a half, I was back out there. I had never quit doing anything I was doing. Got into gambling. I don't have anything against gambling, except I just don't do it well. And it's that same inside good feeling when a pit boss welcomes you in and everything. It's the same feeling you get from taking a drink. It feels good. And I didn't change anything. I had a few more relationships that overlapped. And after about a year and a half of getting worse and losing a lot of weight, and my wife and I were in counseling because she wasn't doing right. And and I finally fessed up that I was back doing my thing, drinking and whatever. And the counselor suggested I go back to that doctor's meeting and get a sponsor and do exactly what I was told. So I said, okay, I wasn't desperate, but I was just trying to get some heat off and everything. So I went back, got a sponsor. He did the same drugs that I did, and he was a physician. And then that started 2 years of daily meetings. I started going to meetings all over town, and I was a guru at meetings. I could tell you some stuff, you know. And some people, when they just get to meetings, they're a little bit shy about sharing and everything. Not me. I mean, if I needed to share twice at a meeting, I would. If I think it needed it and everything. And sometimes when they're going down the row and it's not going to get to me, I'll get up to get coffee and sit in that row and everything, so I get called on. I felt y'all need to hear what I had to say. And then I had these little Hazleton pamphlets with all these little topics on letting go, acceptance, honesty, and everything. And I'd sit out in the car for a meeting. And they're little two or three little page pamphlets. And I'd read about two or three of them. And let me tell you, if the topic of that meeting was on one of those pamphlets that I just read, y'all were in for a treat. Because I was going to let y'all know exactly what I knew about recovery. And guess what? Every time I shared, you know what they'd say? Keep coming back. And let me tell you, to an alcoholic that's full of it, that doesn't know he's full of it, when they say keep coming back, what that means to me is, man, you're really saving the bacon on this meeting. I mean, I'm not sure we can meet anymore if you don't show up. You didn't do that, did you, Randy? Needless to say, that lasted about 2 years, and I snuck out there, and right before I got my two-year chip, I started drinking again, but I went. I still got my two-year coin and everything. And there's, I'm gonna tell you what. There's nothing worse than getting a medallion and people congratulating you, and you knowing you don't deserve it. And the only thing that'll take that pain away, the only thing that'll make it be all right, is to do some more drinking, and that covers it up and everything. And then, you know, you just sort of drift away from meetings, and that lasted about 2 years. You know, I'd go to a few meetings, but, you know, everybody would say, where you been? Well, I'm going to this meeting, or this, and that. And that was 2 years of some real craziness of doing a lot of narcotics and a lot of drinking. And I'll tell you how bad it got. This is how bad it got. I had a bypass surgery at age 44. And in order to have a bypass, anybody in here had a heart catheterization before? There's some people old enough to have heart catheterizations. Yeah. Well, in order to have a heart catheterization, they go up, they numb the groin, and they thread a catheter up the groin into the base of the heart and inject some dye in there so they can take a picture. So I'd had numerous heart catheterizations. And I had been on in all this time that I was in and out, and I had been on a peer assistance surveillance. Never been in any trouble with the doctor, but they knew I'd been in and out. And occasionally on some unofficial drug screens, he'd call me up and say, "Lee, come over and leave a drug screen." And if I happened to be not drinking or not doing anything, I'd zip over there and leave a clean drug screen. Well, in order to do this heart catheterization, they have to give you drugs for the pain and, you know, some strong drugs. So he called me one time and he said, "Come over and leave a drug screen." And it wasn't going to be clean. I'd been drinking and I'd been doing whatever. And then I put my keen alcoholic mind to good use. So I went and told my partner, "I'm having chest pain." So they could take me down and do a heart catheterization on me in order to cover up a dirty drug screen. That sounds normal, doesn't it? You know, we laugh about a lot of things. We laugh about a lot of things we did, and you bring a non-alcoholic that doesn't know anything about recovery in here, they sit here not cracking a smile and say, "That is not funny." And I've tried to tell people, I said, "We're not laughing at what we did. We're laughing at what we were thinking when we did it. We didn't think it was a bad idea." And so the next day he called me up and says, "Where were you?" I said, "Well, I had a heart catheterization. Everything, they opened up a little bit of artery there. Everything was okay." And I said, "Good, I'm glad you're all right." A week later, he called me back. And I'm thinking, "Why are you doing it this soon? I hadn't quit yet." So I had some more chest pain. I had another heart catheterization, right, a week later. And it says we'll go to any length to get what we wanted. I was going to any length to get what I wanted, to cover up whatever it took. And that was a time where I just didn't think it was a bad idea. That's craziness. That's insanity. And you know what? And I've told that story so many times at different treatment centers. So many people have come up to me and said, "Yeah, I had my knee replaced so I could get drugs." Right. So many people have been through similar situations. "I am not unique," and everything, or "I did this and I did that, and I hid this and all that." And by hook or crook, what happened is a few things were crazy. I was 50 pounds lighter, wasn't eating, losing my practice. I think my partners were stealing my patients is what I thought. What reason was I come in at 8 and cancel everything after 10? And I'd go play golf, or I'd go to a sordid place, or wherever. And I finally walked into my wife, and I said, "I'm out of here. I have found the girl who understands. Y'all are just gonna have to get used to Dad being happy." And she looked at me and realized that you're crazy. I mean, I was sweating to death, and I'd lost all this weight. I was like a skeleton. And she called the peer review people and said, "Come get him. He's crazy." So they had a little intervention for me. And so I sat down there and I fessed up to what was going on. And he said, "We think you need the gift of recovery, of treatment." I said, "No, I think I know this AA stuff. I'm going back to treatment. I'm going back to AA. I'm going to get a sponsor. I'm going to do it right this time." And I go like that and they go like that. And by hook or crook, I end up in treatment. It was a lot of legal wrangling and a lot of threats, and you know, we don't do anything unless we're threatened. I don't. And there was a possibility of there's some license, so I went to treatment. I get there, and you move into these apartments, and I read the pamphlet about the program in the impaired professional program. It said 10 to 16 weeks. I said, "I'm out of here in 10. I called my office. Said, "I'll be put some patients down for 10 weeks from Monday." This was a Thursday. This was in June of 01. And I was the guru of treatment because I had been, the people in treatment looked up to me. I was big shot. And the guru of treatment is really the valedictorian of the remedial reading class is what it is. And you know what? I did get out in 10 weeks. They threw me out. I wasn't getting it. I didn't relapse, but I broke every rule they had. Rules didn't apply to me. I make rules for people. I think you ought to change this rule for me. I need to be able to go to AA meeting without a buddy system and all that. And finally they threw me out. I said, we can't help you. And I called up the people in Nashville. I said, go to Copac, which is outside of Jackson, Mississippi, which is a little Spartan area, which is not what I was used to. It wasn't apartments. This was mountain living. So I had 3 days before I got thrown out on a Thursday, and I was going Monday to that treatment center when a bed was available, and my wife let me come home for those 3 days. She was back to work. She was in Al-Anon and all this, and she said, you do what you want to do. Hang around here if you want, but I'm going to work. And so I was in the house with my children. They're teenagers, and I'm going by, and I'm just sitting around there bored, and I'm still not getting any of this, and I go by. I go into one room to talk to them, and all of a sudden this door slams. I go to talk to the other child, and this door slams. And all of a sudden, I'm in a house that nobody wants me there. And if there's a place where you can just, I don't know why it hit me that day, it was the pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization that I didn't belong. Nobody was buying Lee's stuff anymore. I had nowhere else to go. The credit cards were maxed out. Nobody wanted me there. My parents were disgusted with me. Everybody had with nothing to do. I had no place else to go, and for the first time in a long time, I just started crying. I called my wife at work and said, I'm going today. And for the first time, I thought, my mind went from, not from what have I done, to what have I become. And that's not a very good place to be, and I don't know why it hit me that way. That was my moment of clarity. And I went to this new treatment center in Jackson, and I went with an entirely different attitude. I just said, tell me what you want me to do. What's the next rule you want me to follow? And it was the most wonderful 3 months, another 3 months I had there, and I needed every day of it. And what I heard there at that time, we had a wonderful big book study there every day when all 65 guys would be around, and this guy would talk about the big book. And he'd always start, whatever topic we were on, he'd always go back to page 60, is it 60, whatever. And that's the part I always sign for a newcomer. It says the first requirement is that we be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. Guys, you're in treatment. Whatever you've done so far hadn't worked. And I heard that. And for the very first time, I was listening to stuff that I'd been told before, but I heard that. And I tell you, the most important thing I heard at that time, he'd say, guys, who's powerless in here? And of course, you know, we're just sitting around, a bunch of guys, you know, stuffed in treatment, raising their hands, and he says, okay, guys, if you're powerless, let me tell you something. If when you get out of here, if you do not read the big book, if you do not get a home group, if you do not work the steps, if you don't get a sponsor, if you don't pray and meditate and do what alcoholics need to do, if you don't do those things, what you're admitting is you're not powerless. What you're admitting is you're doing things, you got a better way to do it. And he did throw in there, he says, that's not only for alcohol. That's for any area of your life. But I didn't hear that part at the time. I hear it now. But I heard that part. And so I was ready to get out when I got out. Like I said, there weren't any yellow ribbons, and my practice was slow, is the best way I can put it. I had plenty of times to go to meeting. And I remember Carl and Arlene. I said, who am I going to get to take me through the steps? Because I'd really never been through the steps. I'd, you know, sort of piddled around with them, you know. And we mentioned Ralph. And I remember after the Unity meeting, I was going to a lot of meetings, and I said, Ralph, would you take me through the steps? And he said, and I expected him to hold me in his arms and say, yes, I'll be glad to. And he said, well, yeah, read the first 164 pages, and when you get through, call me. Okay. I didn't, that's not what I expected to hear, but that's sort of the way he cuts people, you know, thins it out. So he was really interested. So I did that for a long time, you know, for I don't know how many days, but I called him up. And I said, I've read the first 164 pages. What do I do now? Let me tell you, when I asked Ralph to take me through the steps, it was not for any spiritual experience. It was not so I could get, it was not so I could get good. It was not so I could get closer to a power greater than myself or get a personal relationship with a higher power. It's because nothing else had worked. That's just, anybody in here watch Deal or No Deal? Anybody like that? That's the way I am. Deal or no deal, they got 100 suitcases up there. One of them's got $5 million, one of them's got one penny and everything. And that's the way we are, except here in Alcoholics Anonymous, we know the suitcase that's got the good stuff in it. We not only do we know which one it is, we'll open it up and show it to you. This is the one. This has got the instructions in it. Pick this one. And what do we do? Go, nah, give me five of those other suitcases there first. Let me have one of those other five in there. Let me see what they say. Oh, they said they had a good party at that night. And the other one says, it's bad luck that you got picked up on that DUI. You know, those policemen ought to be looking for real criminals and everything. And just don't drive. You don't have a drinking problem. You got a driving problem and everything. That's what all these suitcases say. Then you pick those five and you say, here's a suitcase. Follow this. This is where the excitement is. This is where the solution is. Deal or no deal. This is it. Let me have about five more of those other suitcases. And we get through all the suitcases, and there's one left, and if you're still alive, we go, give me that one. That's what I do with Ralph. Take me through the steps. And I could do a whole 2 hours on what my experience with the steps with Ralph is. It was the most wonderful time, and naturally, just like anything else in this program, I didn't know it when I was doing it. Everything the book describes is when we look back, we see what good comes when we put ourselves in God's hands. But when you're going through it, I just did it because Ralph told me to do it. We did it a step a week, and on step four, he did. You know, I remember there were some highlights in there on the unmanageability. He took me to page 52, the unmanageability paragraph. Prey to misery, depression, couldn't make a living, whatever it says. I said, check, check. I got all those problems. He wanted to make sure that I associated with that. And he knew he did. With that paragraph, full of fear and all that. And I said, yeah, I've got those. He said, well, good. He said, and you'll have them, and you'll continue to have them. The solution will be the same then as it is now. So I went through the steps, and there was so much, oh, gosh, and it was so much I could, what am I doing? All right, we're doing all right. And, you know, I didn't ask Ralph, but I asked somebody. He says, what about these men's on patients I was taking care of, impaired? What do I do? And it was told to me by my sponsor. He says, you know, I used to hate to go to church and stand in the fellowship hall afterwards and have the people that were my patients sort of lining up to ask me medical questions. And I thought that was beneath me. Call me during my office hours and everything. And I used to hate that line that people would impose upon me. He says, what you're going to do is when you get in church, you're going to answer them. You're going to be grateful you got a job. And when you're outside of an AA meeting, if anybody wants to ask you a medical question, you're going to answer it. You're going to say, and if you can, you can. If you don't have any information on it and you don't want to comment on somebody else's case, you're going to tell them that too. And that's how you're going to make amends. He says, another reason is when you're sitting outside an AA meeting and you need some information about your car, and you need some information about selling your house and everything, you don't have any problem with going up to anybody else and asking them, do you? I said, no. He says, you want mercy for you and justice for everybody else. You want everybody else to act this way, but you're going to do it like this. And so I've continued to do that. And that's been part of my amends on that. And whether it's people calling me at home or whatever, and I want to tell you, I didn't do this real well sometimes, and I didn't do it with an inside feeling like, why are they doing this right now? But I just did it. Y'all told me I didn't have to be anybody. Y'all told me I have to be spiritual. Y'all told me I didn't have to try to. Y'all just had me. Y'all told me I had to do certain things. The spiritual program of action. And this is what I did. And this is when we got to steps 10. You know, in 10 and 11 about this prayer, hey, here's the best thing about that prayer. I just need to do it. I don't have to believe it. I don't have to want to do it. And don't you love that resentment prayer on 552? Even if you don't mean it when you're praying for somebody else. You know, and what am I going to tell God? Says, God, I don't mean this, but I'm praying for that. God knows what's in my heart. There has never been anything I have prayed to God about, and he goes, ooh, I didn't know that. He knows exactly what's going on with me. And so I'm just supposed to do these prayers, and I do that morning prayer. In the morning I go to the hospital chapel after I make rounds, and it's always quiet in there. And I do the prayers that it says on page 83, ask him in the morning with your family to practice patience, tolerance, kindliness, and love. and then go to page there later when it says to be devoid of self. It says we consider our plans for the day. And it says be devoid of self-pity, self-seeking, and dishonest motives. That generally kills my plans for the day, but that's the way I'm supposed to pray. And then it says on page 164, ask Him in your morning meditation what you can do for the person who is still sick. You know what? Those prayers take about 5 seconds, and many times I'm thinking about somewhere else, but a lot of times I'm sitting there on my knees at the prayer rail in the chapel saying, God, I don't mean this. I'm just doing this because I'm supposed to, and I'm supposed to stay sober. That's the beauty of this program. We don't have to mean it. We don't have to want to. And the amazing thing is we don't have to believe it's going to work, but you just do it. Hello? How easy can you? And all you got to do is give it back to somebody else. Go help somebody else. So, you know, and that's been such a freeing thing for me. And then you get into step 12 and going and helping somebody else, working with people like Dave, and what, you know, he doesn't understand every time, you know, you've helped me so much. And it's that same worn out thing, Dave, you've helped me more than I've helped you. I mean, that's the essence of this program, is one alcoholic talking to another. That's two liars getting together trying to figure out the truth. And I mean, And that's just the way it works. How are you going to, you know, God is speaking to me through other people. And you know, I have never had anybody follow me out of a meeting after I've shared and say, oh, gosh, I'm changing my way of life because of what you said and everything. You know, that's yet to happen. But I tell you what's happened is somebody will come up to me and say, you know, we were talking 6 months ago and we were talking about what, I already remember talking to them, and they said, you said something, you were talking to somebody else and you said something, and that got me to thinking, and that's just the way, and that's the way it works. And because God, you know, the book says our main purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and our fellow man. It doesn't say to be of maximum service, it says to fit ourselves. So I'm supposed to get fit. How do I get fit? It's not by exercise. It's by exercising the things you told me to do. Show up at meetings. Read the book. Pray and meditate. Talk to that sponsor that I'm supposed to do the three things with. Here's what I'm supposed to do with my sponsor. I'm supposed to tell him what I'm thinking, what I'm doing, and what I'm thinking of doing. And if I can get into that place where I'm that honest with another human being, I'll get to hear God's voice speak through him. If I get fit, I'll be in a place where I'll be able to help somebody. And the nice thing is, most of the time, I don't even know it. That's okay. That's a big deal for somebody like me who wants some attention and who wants some recognition. And the next, that says it on 77, on page 102, it says, well, your main job is to be at a place where you can help be a service to somebody. I'm supposed to be at that place. And the amazing thing is, I don't even know what that place is. I don't have to know. This is such an easy program. I mean, so it's such a simple program. It's not easy for a self-centered alcoholic like me because I don't want to do those things. As simple as that is, I don't want to do them. Go figure. So I'm just supposed to do these things and God uses me, and what I get back is just amazing. And, you know, the main thing is I always wanted to be loved and needed. I just spent my whole life doing it the wrong way. Whatever means I could become loved and needed. And what y'all told me to do is to give love and to help somebody else. And when I do that, I'm loved and needed. It makes sense when you're doing it and when you've been through it. But until then, it makes no sense at all. It becomes, you know, even if it's acting as if, I still got to do it. And I've managed to do it because for 8 years, I hadn't had the obsession to drink or do drugs. Go figure. And I'm not sure which one of these parts is the one responsible for all this. I don't want to quit any of them. That being the case, I have quit some of them off and on. You know, I've quit praying sometimes. What does the 12 and 12 say about that prayer? That's okay. Sometimes we're just rebellious about prayer. When you get over it, just start back from where you were. We get a break on all this stuff. God just wants, He does want me to sow gratitude. The God of my understanding, this is my understanding. When He healed 10 people and only one of them showed up to say thank you, He wanted to know where the other 9 were. So I'm supposed to show gratitude to my higher power, and how do I do that? By helping somebody else. So this is just, it's just been a journey in progress, and I'll tell you some of the other things that's happened in my life. My father and I have we didn't restore that relationship. We just have a new relationship. He has dinner at a certain restaurant every Friday night at 5 o'clock. Unless I'm doing something, I'm always there. And it's not real deep conversation. He's 84 years old, and he's sort of the patriarch of the restaurant, and everybody comes by and pays homage to him and everything, all the waiters and everything. He's been coming there for 50 years. And I'm there, and we don't get real deep about anything. He's just glad, number one, I'm going. He said, "You going to meetings?" I said, "Yep." He's glad I'm back at work and back at home. That's all he's happy about. And that's okay with him. And occasionally he'll, I can remember, I'll tell you what I remember is early on in my recovery, once, you know, before I really got sober, he was giving a sermon. He was filling in. And he gave this sermon on how to get closer to God. And it was a three-part recipe on how to get closer to God. He said, humility, service, and gratitude. I turned around and asked my wife, I said, "You think he's been going to some open meetings?" And she said something that I never thought of. I said, "No, he's been putting that out for about 50 years. You know, when it says in the book, be quick to see what other religious, you know, religious people have had this stuff way before we did. It just took some thunderbolt hitting Bill W. for God to use him to get our attention and for us to do this. And that's just the way it is with me. And we're all right. My mother, all she ever cared about was, "Hey, you doing all right?" Whenever I call her, she's not at the casino. I say I'm doing fine, whether I am or not. But most of the time I am. I just don't know it sometimes. The guy that threw me out of treatment, there where I was. Gosh, was I hacked at him. But him and two of them, Ken T and Abbott J. And I can't believe they threw me out. Everybody else was relapsing. There was a cesspool of rule breakers there, and they threw me out. But that's what it took, and I remember seeing him at a meeting later on after I got sober, and I went up and hugged him. I said, and you know, when I went to COPAC there for that team, they told me to pray for him for 2 weeks. I was praying for him every day for 3 months. I was, you know, I didn't deserve this. Why was I singled out to get thrown out? I said, "Thanks for saving my life." And he said, "That wasn't me, that was God." I said, "Yeah, but he worked through you." And I had that feeling right then and there from I used to think, why was I singled out? And it just moved into the perception as, why was I chosen to get sober? I don't think I'd have gotten sober if I'd have just been gotten out in another 2 weeks and gone back to whatever. Because I wasn't getting it at the time. It took that for that to happen. Did they know that? I don't know. Later on, I had lunch with him one day, and we were going over the corporate part of dismissing people from treatment, the financial part and whatever, and sometimes they have to keep people, you know, if they're insurance, you know, when they should dismiss people. And I said, "Well, what about me?" And I expected him to say, "We really worked hard and long about thinking about throwing you out." And the first thing out of his mouth is, "Oh, there's no question, we couldn't help you. you were easy, you were gone." And that caught me off guard. My children, my oldest daughter was a freshman at college when I went to treatment. None of the children were real happy with me. Their finances, the finances were a disaster. It was a lot of embarrassing things that were happening to them at school. And my oldest daughter was a freshman at Notre Dame, and my wife had moved her up there while I was in treatment. And the first football weekend, I got a break. I got to leave, and I was coming up there for the football weekend, and she asked her mother, "Does Dad have to come to this? I really don't want him here." But I did, and she said, "Yeah, you know, he's trying to do better and all this." And I went up there. It was not a very fun weekend. She was not happy I was there. And 4 years later, when she graduated, I'd go up there by myself for a football weekend and stay in the hotel. And we had dinner together, and we sat across and said, "Dad, I love you, and I'm glad you got sober, and I'm glad you're here this weekend." That doesn't happen just by quitting drinking. You don't go from point A to point B and say you quit drinking and this just happens. There's a program of recovery where I didn't know I was changing. People see it in you. You have to see it all the time. And in July, I'm getting to walk her down the aisle. That's a big deal. Now, that's a whole different thing of letting go about these wedding plans. Don't let me get started about that. That's using the program. So right now, I'm just using what I was told of shut mouth, open wallet. And that's doing a whole lot better on that one. So my youngest daughter was 16 at the time, and she came to treatment when I was still here and brought me this long letter. And it basically said she was denouncing me as her father. She was divorcing herself of me as a parent. I had nothing to offer her as a father. She was totally embarrassed. And there was an upcoming, there was a big deal at the private school, a father-daughter dance. And he says, I do not want you taking me to that. I'd rather not go. And this was, and she was very angry. And now she just got her nursing degree. And when she, and we became real good friends. And she and I, you know, the only two in the family that eat sushi. And when the traveling plays are in town in Memphis, we'll go. She and I always have a date for with a play. We go eat sushi first. And whenever she had trouble in her nursing school, I'm the one she called. She was just she texted me Friday night. She was at the basketball game asking me some stuff. And she's my good buddy. That's another thing you don't get just from quitting drinking. My oldest son, here's a little jobby right here. He was 19 at the time. And when I was in treatment here, he was doing his thing. He's one of us. And he had to go to treatment at Copac, where I ended up. So Mom had two people in treatment at the same time. She had a full plate. And after 3 weeks with him at Copac, I'll give you this timeline. I'm sitting up here in Memphis. He's down in Jackson, Mississippi. And after 3 weeks, he calls his mother and said, I don't belong here. I'm not that bad. Mother forgot every bit of Al-Anon she ever knew and went and got him. She had, first of all, she called 30 people in her Al-Anon group, and 30 people said, don't go get him. She went and got him and brought him home. Moved him out of his two apartments and out of his drug-infested area he was living. Moved him back home. He had a new idea. He was going to go to school, get a new job, and everything. So after I got thrown out of the Memphis Treatment Center, I had to go to Copac where he had been. And if he'd have still been there, I wouldn't have gone there. They wouldn't have taken me at the same time because of having family there. So I got sober down there at Copac. That's where I heard the message. As I was finishing at Copac, he crashed and burned and almost died in the emergency room and decided he needed help, and he called Copac back, and they took him. And they wouldn't have taken him back there if I'd have still been there. So he got sober down there, and we both heard the message of recovery down there. And he stayed in Jackson, Mississippi 9 months and lived in the inpatient apartments and got sober, and he called me one day and says, I want to go to college. I said, Matt, you flunked everywhere you ever been. He said, yeah, but I wrote him a letter. This Millsaps down there in Jackson, this little high-dollar liberal arts school and everything. And I said, they're not going to take you there. It's too hard to get into. He said, yeah, but I wrote him a letter. I told him I was in recovery, and will they take me? And they took him. No figure. And 4 years later, he graduated from Millsaps. And now he's at the University of Wisconsin. He's gotten his master's in classical languages. Don't ask me what he's going to do with it. But 2 years of that, now he's on his PhD. He's teaching freshman Latin and freshman Greek at University of Wisconsin. Is this tapestry arranged? Am I supposed to get sober? Were we supposed to get sober in different places? I don't know. And at the same place, and was it arranged like this? I don't know. But God, I'm understanding, there's no time or limitation. I'll buy it. I've got my oldest child from my first marriage. Poor guy, he's just like me in every way, shape, or form when it comes to gambling, women, and alcohol and drugs. And when I was 2 years sober, I was out there visiting. He was living in Phoenix. And, you know, he had about 30 jobs since he got out of college. And if he wasn't CEO of a job in 3 weeks, he quit. And his life was a mess. I knew it. Everybody knew it. He didn't know it. And I'm going to meetings every day while I'm down there. I go to the 7 a.m. meeting in Phoenix. It's an awesome meeting, 100 people there. And I'd come home and said, Nick, your life's a mess. If you ever want to quit doing what you're doing, why don't you go to that meeting I was at? And I left in my pocket big book, and you know, and I just thought there wasn't anything I could do for him. And 6 weeks later, he emailed me. He said, I went to that meeting, the noon meeting, and somebody assigned himself to be my sponsor. And I went out to lunch with these guys, and he's been on fire for this program ever since. He's got 5 years of sobriety. And he got married in this time. He got married on Founders Day 3 years ago out there in Phoenix to a wonderful girl. I mean, you know, what he was used to dating, and every time they'd break up, crazy women he was dating. The police were called and everything. No, it was just, but he, this is a wonderful girl, and he got sober. Did I get sober so I could 12-step my son? I don't know. But that's the way it worked out in my life. Let me tell you a few other things now. And this is part of what's going on in my life right now. All of a sudden, my son is gone to church. And he tells, I've talked to his AA friends out there, and the quote is, "I've been saved. I don't need AA anymore." And that ripped my guts out. I don't know what to do about that except talk to somebody. And the only thing that makes this palatable to me, makes it okay, is when the book says, "We have no monopoly on God." There's a lot of ways of spiritual experience. We just know what works for us. And I'm okay with that. I don't like it. I accept it. Nowhere in the book does it say I got to like it. But I accept it. And I tell you, when I'm good at acceptance, number one, when things are going my way, and number two, when I try everything I can think of to make it work, and I finally have to accept it. But he's all right. He's happy as a clam. He's just in the church. He's doing whatever. And my oldest, my son that's in Wisconsin, he's not going to the program, but he got sober, and he says he's drinking socially with his buddy. I know he's not doing drugs, but he's still in school. And that's okay. And that youngest daughter that's a nurse, she's my earth child. I don't know where she's going to end up. She still smokes pot because it comes from the earth. But she's happy as a clam. I gotta stay out of her stuff. She's probably the smartest one of all my kids. But she's never letting school or anything get in the way of her partying or anything. I don't know. But it's been a journey. Oh, my wife and I, we're still together. Go figure. 29 years. I'm gonna tell you, the reason we stayed together early on was pure and simple finances. It was cheaper. And we looked at each other and we said, we're gonna let God decide this one. It has been a tumultuous 8 years. It's been coming and going. If you ask me, I'll tell you it's her fault. If you ask her, she'll tell you it's my fault. Plain and simple. And there's been a lot of counseling. There's been a lot of this. There's been a lot of that. And at times we've looked at each other and said, it's never been like this before. At times she's looked at me and say, you're still the most selfish, self-centered ass I've ever seen. And he said, you're acting just like an alcoholic. I said, it's not an act. I don't know. And we're still together. And things are going good. We're planning this wedding. I'm not planning this wedding anymore. But we've had more consistent agreeing on things over how this wedding should be than anything we've ever had in 29 years. And sometimes I think the only reason God keeps us together still is to spare two other people. But it is like it is today, and it's been a journey. And I want to thank Milton again for asking me. I want to tell you the most. I remember hearing the thing that I thought was really impressive early on: the definition of insanity, doing the same things over. And I used to quote, when I heard that, I'd quote that over and over like it was something new, doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results. I want to tell you the definition of recovery: doing the same thing over and over again and getting the same results. I'm going to keep doing it. Thank you.